Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our minds for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 187, Murder, Death, Kill.
Yes. Do people know about Demolition Man anymore? The classic...
I'm sure that everyone knows about an obscure 1997, maybe?
Starring Dennis Rodman as a villain.
Not Dennis Rodman, Dave. Racist. That's actually Wesley Snipes.
You're
Simon
right.
Phoenix.
Simon
what
Phoenix.
Was Dennis
you
Rodman
were
in?
Charged 125 credits for not knowing.
Dennis Rodman was in Double Trouble with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
That's accurate.
Yeah, okay.
Or was that not Double Trouble? That might be one they were. That
double
was Double
team.
Trouble.
It was Double Team.
Double Team.
Now who's the racist?
See? I don't think that's how that works.
But I feel that... So who was the bad guy in this?
Simon Phoenix, a.k.a. Wesley Snipes.
But wasn't he Rodmaning it up? His hair was Rodman-esque, right?
I mean,
yes, his hair was Rodman-esque.
Basically, the Wesley Snipes haircut. That's what he had.
Yeah.
Did he didn't have, like, the dyed hair and
he
all that stuff?
He did have dyed hair.
He was pulling a Rodman.
Okay.
When you say Rodman, I always think of, like, green hair or some random crazy color.
He did not
color.
Have green hair.
He had, like, blonde hair, right?
Yeah.
Here's the thing, Dave. You may not know this, but there are other black men who have dyed hair besides Rodman.
That was the style at the time that Rodman made a thing.
This also had Sylvester Stallone.
Right?
And
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock is her first major role, I believe.
Benjamin Bratt.
I think the important thing is that people should see it.
Yes.
It's actually kind of, for a dumb movie, it's surprisingly funny. And
it's a goofy dumb movie.
There's hilarious satire in it.
Yeah.
Celebrate our 187th podcast by watching Demolition Man and telling us what you think.
Yes.
Tell us what your theories are on the seashells.
Yeah, what do the seashells do?
Enjoy the presence of comedian...
Rob Schneider.
Nope. Underground leader.
Dennis Leary.
Dennis Leary
no
is underground
Rob
leader.
Schneider.
Nope.
No. I just now remember
and,
that he was
And some pretty cool action and stuff like that. It's actually decently designed. Buy yourself Taco Bell. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
Have a little Taco Bell meal, then feel sick the next day.
Yeah, get some Taco Bell. Sit down with Demolition Man, which I really don't know what it was made. I swear it's a 90s movie.
It is.
I know I saw it in the theater. And enjoy our 187th... Just watch it without the sound on and enjoy our podcast over it.
I do feel that it's Sandra Bullock's hottestness.
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
Hottiestness.
Yeah, I agree. I concur. All right, so... That's
podcast?
Where we go from here.
Yeah.
So thanks for tuning in
to the Demolition Man podcast.
Yo, Joe. Okay, so store news. We have, again, November is a quietish month for us.
Right.
Which, other than
one of the biggest sales day of the years.
Yes.
But other than that.
But the early parts of November, I don't know if people know this, but retail struggles in November. We're ordering a ton of stuff for Christmas holiday sales.
But it won't sell for a little bit.
And it won't sell until December. And people tend to get a little, you know, close down their finances a little bit and tighten up a little bit. You know, we're saving up for holidays. And so November can be a bit rough for holidays. I've seen several resellers posting about that.
Yeah.
So this is a good month to come in and spend some money with us and make us feel a little less panicked.
I will say a lot of cool stuff has already begun appearing.
Yeah.
So we're talking about like the Buffy deck building game
based
on the very popular Legendary system, which also has all the Marvel characters, Firefly, Aliens, all kinds of stuff.
You don't have to mix any of them. No.
Yeah, it's just a popular system.
But also, The Thing, Infection Outpost 31.
Yeah, that is based on John Carpenter's epic The Thing, and very, very tuned in on the vibe of the movie with hidden infected characters.
Yep.
And
it's co-op, but you don't know who the things are. You might secretly be a thing, and I actually play tested this, and it's super fun. It goes 4 to 8 players, and I'm super excited to play it.
Yep.
There's also, Pandemic Legacy Season 2.
Season 2, which is one of my favorite games from last year.
Really, you should also just be getting Black Hammer the trade paperback.
Because Randy was right. Can we do the Randy Was Right song?
Randy was right.
It makes me happy you've been working on it. I was hoping for a little more drums and synth, but I'll take it.
We're
That's
working on that. We'll
production.
Talk to Jarek, who does our theme song.
Jarek will do a Randy Was Right song.
Yeah.
But anyway, November's a little quiet at the outset, but end of the month, Saturday, November 18th, we will have our local comic shop day. We just got a bunch of exclusive stuff. Variants, hardcovers. Nick, anything you want to shout out from that list?
Well, there's some really cool hardcovers from Black Mask. They're doing Young Terrorist as a hardcover and Four Kids Walk Into a Bank.
Yeah.
But both of those look great. and the Batman Hush Collector's Edition and Planet Hulk. Those are all, they all look great.
And we have a handful of those, so come in on Local Comic Shop Day and pick those up. There's also some variant covers. Then later that night, Codenames will be, our old pal Chris will be running that for us.
Yep.
So you can come in, and it'll start about 6:45. Come in and play the party game Codenames. We'll do the dual version, or duet version, and then there'll probably be some other versions as well.
What makes the duet version the duet version?
It's more of like a team-based kind of thing.
Oh, neat.
Also you sing.
And also you sing. I mean, you don't have to, but you can.
Oh, is that the Disney version of Codenames?
That's the Disney version.
Okay, that makes
honestly,
more sense.
Really, all games are like that,
yes.
If you think about it.
Yes, all games are doing
it. You don't have to.
I mean, I broke out in song in Pandemic Legacy. It was cool.
Can somebody give me a beat? All right, what do I got?
All right. Doomsday Clock Midnight Release will be Tuesday, November 21st. I guess that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that is pretty big.
That is DC's Watchmen book that is going to...
The Watchmen sequel.
Yeah. Watchmen sequel.
Call it what it is.
We'll have a release at 11:57, minutes to midnight.
Yep.
Right before the squid explodes and kills.
Right, read it real quick.
Yeah.
You will probably detonate within minutes.
But then there'll be world peace.
Then there'll be world peace for...
And it's a shaky world
a little
peace,
bit.
But, you know,
well, and then there'll be a sequel Superman.
Yes.
Anyway, Doomsday Clock number 1 comes out midnight, Tuesday, November 21st. We will be here and open for that. And we'll have some more stuff. We're working on plans.
Yep.
Plans and schemes.
Just like
Ozymandias.
Shh, don't tell people that.
And then later that week, Black Friday.
Yes.
Friday, November 24th is our post-Thanksgiving sale. Always a big deal. Basically, you spend $25, you get $5 in gift certificates. If you're a card member, you spend you get $5 for every $20 you spend.
Yep.
So come on out.
People take excellent advantage of this,
yeah.
And then they have cool holiday buy-in gift certificates,
yep.
for their pals.
Yep. Or
for themselves. Yeah. There ain't no shame.
All right, not a lot of news this week, but kind of some big news. So we're gonna start small and then scale up. First bit of news is that The Orville is getting a second season, been confirmed, just like Discovery has.
Yeah, as it turns out, there is enough room for two Star Trek shows, one official one and one unofficial one.
One that is Seth MacFarlane's fanfic.
Yes.
Are you still watching this?
Yeah.
Are you still digging it?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Nick, did you go off?
I never watched
it. Nick hasn't
it.
Seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
The Seth MacFarlane thing just has really
I think you're going to like it.
I mean, I probably would, but...
You should give it a shot and just see what you think.
There's too much other television on right now. I can't even keep up with that.
Yeah, it got a second season without you.
I'm 4 episodes behind in Discovery.
That's crazy talk.
Discovery you should definitely catch up on. It has these sort of... It's a deeper show and probably overall really the better show. It's just that it doesn't fulfill the niche that Orville does of sort of being the... You know, like very kind of upbeat, solve a problem each week, some nice character development. There's a lot more sort of kind of like more heartfelt moments that kind of occur on the Orville. So I was happy to see it renewed. Also, it has like a surprisingly good special effects and stuff.
Yeah.
Like the ship looks great, the uniforms look great, and all that stuff.
I sort of went off it, but I'm glad it got renewed. I think it's good to be out there for people who like it.
What was I going to say? Discovery, though, Nick, I will say, like, I think you may have fallen off right about where I think it particularly got good.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind.
It's not
if you're
one of those
like,
things that I'm like...
I could take it or leave it.
It's not one of those things that I'm done with. It's more of a life got in the way, and I haven't had a chance to watch it.
Yeah, that's
now it's time for life to find a way.
See, Discovery is the show that I watch first almost every time. Like I watch it almost live on Sundays.
Really?
It's my favorite show right now.
The way that they are, the importance of the serialization to it, it does feel like every week something kind of notable happens.
Yeah.
There is some sort of notable development. Ironically, I did feel that this week's episode was a little bit weaker.
I agree. It was the first episode I found was a little weaker.
That's okay.
But it's still
good. It wasn't like, oh, they tanked or something like that.
They did not jump the warp shark or whatever.
Yes. They did not jump the space tardigrade.
They did not jump the space tardigrade. But yeah, I'm glad Orville got a second season. I probably won't be watching, but I'm glad for people who enjoy it.
That was a nice backhanded compliment.
Okay.
you're like, that's as good as it gets.
Twilight Zone is apparently getting a CBS All Access reboot with Jordan Peele at the helm, or at least one of the executive producers.
You know, so this would be the second, I guess, notable Twilight Zone reboot after an mid-late 80s era.
Second
reboot?
Or third? Did it have another one? Did it have more?
The 90s?
I feel like there was a short-lived one in the 90s.
Yeah, I'm trying to... I guess I'm kind of just calling the major ones.
Yeah.
I definitely remember watching the new Twilight Zone in, like, the late 80s. And yeah. It was, had some spooky episodes and some episodes I liked, but also did kind of... It didn't... Nothing can make the mark the original did.
Right.
But,
however,
if you're gonna do it,
yeah.
Jordan Peele...
Yeah, Jordan Peele is proven... I mean, we've only seen... We've seen Key and Peele, and we've seen Get Out.
Yeah.
And I guess Keanu, which technically is more Key and Peele. But right. Like, we've only seen Get Out from him, but I think everyone was like, whoa, this guy's got some depth we did not see.
Right. It was, like, worked on so many levels
yeah.
that it was... It's easy to see how this could work.
If he can
in a way, Get Out plays just like a extended Twilight Zone episode... with some extreme violence in it.
That's what I was going to say, is if he can bring that sort of social sci-fi and horror to mm-hmm. Twilight Zone, it could be as relevant as it was in the 60s
yeah.
when it was that... Was yeah. it 60s or 50s?
60s.
Okay, that's what
60s,
I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like he's the guy who could bring that yeah. voice to it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's shows out there that have a sort of... The only thing about Twilight Zone is that... Well, you look at something like Black Mirror, which does yep. this social satire through a science
sure.
fiction lens... and is extremely cynical and jaundiced. Twilight Zone was also kind of in its way cynical. Like, if you ever see, like, some of their most famous episodes, the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street
yep.
and stuff like that, it is actually pretty cynical, too. It has a cynical view of how people turn on each other and scapegoat
yeah.
With the kind of awesome revelation that basically aliens are plotting, but not overtly, they're letting us destroy ourselves.
Whoa, spoilers.
Spoiler alert for, yes, for 1963. but anyway, so the question is, can a new Twilight Zone find enough to set itself apart?
Right.
You know what I think would be interesting, and this maybe Get Out may suggest something else for this, is Get Out has a good deal of humor in it. Some of it's slightly larger than life for something that was a little bit kind of, you know, could have been very, very straightforward.
Right.
And I think that worked to its advantage. And I feel like if Twilight Zone brought a bit of humor, it always had some wit to it.
Yeah.
But I think some humor in there would be good. I could definitely see it. There was, like, so much to talk about
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, I could, too. And here's the other thing.
And sometimes people don't... It's like you have to see some story with a stupid alien in it to get a concept.
Right.
You know?
So, the other thing is, the other half of this is the CBS All Access thing. This would have made me nervous before Discovery.
Yeah.
But Discovery has shown that they're willing to sort of take chances and have a little more edge and say something with their show. And
yeah.
Now I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah, they could actually turn their CBS All Access into something
into
with
a thing.
This. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so, they already had it going with Star Trek Discovery, but yeah, a really strong new Twilight Zone series.
And there are some people who like The Good Fight.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
It's their Good Wife spinoff that they wind up launching All Access with when Discovery was late.
Out of curiosity, do you know how it's doing within that?
I don't know. I know less of my compatriot on TV dudes
like
it.
Is The Good Wife, is that the Juliana Margulies thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, The Good Fight is the Christine Baranski, maybe? Something like that?
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Anyway, Les likes it. He's on my TV podcast.
Yeah.
So
he's not insane.
He's not insane.
He's a little out there.
He's a little out there.
But he's not insane.
Yeah. No. He's not fully crazy. All right. The big news. I got two sort of big news. This just dropped this morning. So Brian Michael Bendis, who's been at Marvel for like 17 years.
Yep.
Yes.
Started out indie, got recruited for
yep,
Marvel,
and has been exclusive with them for a long, long time.
And became so huge that he's like written like several of the last major events, created Ultimate Spider-Man, Miles Morales, created Jessica Jones,
Destroy put together the Avengers.
Put together Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. Yeah, we could also go through his sins, but
he has worked on everything. He worked on Fantastic Four, not Fantastic Four, X-Men, Avengers,
Guardians,
like
Iron Man,
literally every character.
Except
Captain America.
Yeah. Captain America and one of
the But, like,
others.
The big ones. I mean, he worked on most of the big ones.
He didn't do Thor.
I mean, he wrote Captain...
Did he never do Thor?
No.
Oh,
He wrote all those because he wrote Avengers.
He can't do Asgardian stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah, in fact, he wrote two Avengers books at one point simultaneously.
Yeah.
But, yes, I think we, Randy, you and I in particular, were kind of very much on board his crime stuff early on.
Yeah.
Then on board his Marvel stuff when it was Ultimate Spider-Man and Daredevil.
And then he destroyed the Avengers and I hated him forever.
Right. Even then, there was, even early before that, there were like some reservations here and there, some like little, oh, he's got some quirks. Yeah. Starting to see some quirks. Nick, are you kind of in that category? An enthusiast who kind of became a little disillusioned?
Yeah, I think I came more on his Ultimate Spider-Man than anything else. I kind of backtracked to his crime stuff.
That series meant a lot to a lot of people. I've known people who that's the book that they that got him into comics.
Yeah, well, I still feel like he has one of the best voices for Peter Parker. I mean, it kind of shone through.
It became his version of Peter Parker.
Well, Spider-Man Homecoming is 100% based on Bendis' Spider-Man.
Yeah,
right. But the big news is that this Marvel guy is going to DC Comics. He's going to be exclusive to DC soon. We don't know exactly when.
So he's not just going over to DC to try out writing Batman or something like that. He is leaving Marvel and putting all his creative energy, presumably, into DC.
This is big news.
Yeah.
Whatever your feelings on it.
And he is a somewhat polarizing guy. We are not the only people in the world who kind of liked him a lot and then didn't like him.
For me, this is great.
Uh-huh.
Because it means Bendis won't be there screwing up characters I like at Marvel. Yeah. And some of the characters he created that I like, that I want other people to put their hand on, like Miles Morales or Riri Williams, that I would like other people to write, now they're free for somebody else to write.
Yep.
Luke Cage and, well, not Luke Cage, Iron Fist, all that, you know, all the stuff that he took for Defenders. Someone else is going to write Defenders. Like, basically, all the stuff that I wanted somebody else to be doing, someone else is going to be doing.
But, honestly, a lot of, as much as we have problems with Bendis, he brought a lot of those characters back and brought a lot of attention to him. He's good at that.
Sure, and so, that's the thing. He's gonna leave Marvel, and all the stuff I liked about what he changed is going to be there, and then the stuff I didn't like about his particular writing is going to be somebody else. So that's great. And now he's over at DC, where honestly, there's no amount of damage you could do that's going to make it worse for me. And I honestly think he's going to be better because he's going to shake things up over there.
Yeah? I'm interested to see what he brings.
And Nick and I were talking about this earlier, and there's also the notion that the fact that when Bendis came to Marvel, this was at a time when Marvel had been like, they had kind of their house writers from the 90s still around, and had not really had anybody who kind of set the world on fire until they grabbed this little indie crime comics guy who had an interesting voice and turned out to have created Ultimate Spider-Man next. Yep. So,
and then that's also the exact same time that Mark Miller came there, that Ed Brubaker came there.
Yep.
Like, all those guys.
Yeah, I would say, like, people like Kieran Gillen, editors like Axel Alonso.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of that was kind of a domino of effect from kind of the broadening of horizons that he brought. Not to say that Joe Quesada and, like, even Bill Gemmis do not deserve some credit for that.
Sure.
But Joe Quesada's Marvel Knights probably the most. And then, Bendis may have overall had the biggest effect on Marvel in, like, the last 15, 20 years.
Oh, for sure.
Than anything else, maybe except for Marvel Knights, which kind of might have started the dominoes.
So for him to go to DC now, I mean, at this point, he is, like I say, he's sort of, his stars fade a little bit. He's not the A-lister that he was, but he is still a notable guy.
He's still writing, like, 3 or 4 books.
And going to DC is going to make him a bigger star again, because now all eyes are going to be whatever he does. Like, I'm not even much of a Bendis fan these days, but I'm definitely going to read whatever he does.
For those who don't, like, there are people who might be listening to this podcast who don't, some people don't pay real close attention to writers and artists, and I think they may not know him necessarily by name. If you were just to describe his style, I would say that he took a lot from cinema, and that David Mamet, the playwright, he very much likes more than anything, even though he certainly does other stuff, but arguably he is best at a couple of characters sitting around talking.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit weird to say about superheroes, and it's one of the reasons why sometimes we don't like him, but he can have some great conversations.
Honestly, one of the best episodes of Defenders was them sitting around a table talking, and it was literally some of the best stuff in the series. So that conversational style tone is what he's coined.
Sure. And it's almost always interesting dialogue, even if it's fight scene dialogue and stuff. It's kind of, he thinks about it a little bit more. His Spider-Man was funnier than I'd seen Spider-Man in a while.
I think that's one of the other things he brings. Yeah. Whatever he does is always funny.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. I think about the MJ issue of Ultimate Spider-Man where Peter Parker revealed himself to her. Was
his,
like,
identity. He revealed his identity.
I don't know. Not the issue I read. So weirder. He revealed his identity to her, which was pretty groundbreaking at the time, and they stayed with that decision in the series, and it's this very heartfelt, realistic conversation. And he's also, though, of course, brought some certain grittiness to, like, his Daredevil was very much following in the Frank Miller style, but, you know, he was bringing his own notions to it. He made Foggy a particularly interesting character. Yeah. You know, maybe some of what made Foggy really interesting on the TV show is probably a little bit owed to him. He explores different directions, even when I don't like him, which is surprisingly often. I can somewhat respect that he almost always approaches a problem, the problem of a plot or stuff, by avoiding normal the tropes and trying to find some new angle.
That's true.
So there's a curiosity factor, even if there's also trepidation about what he'll do at DC.
Yeah. Now, Nick, you're more on board DC than either of us.
Yeah.
Are you nervous about this?
No, I think it's a good thing. Honestly,
because they'll shake it up, or just because you like his writing enough that you
no, I think
you'll think you'll like the
up.
Books.
I think they're going to hire him to do, I don't know what book, but I would fathom it probably to be Justice League.
I think Justice League is a likely one too. Dave and I were talking about this off mic, and I pointed out to him he has another theory, which we'll get into in a second. But we know that Brian Hitch is leaving.
Yeah.
We know they haven't really assigned a permanent new writer.
Yeah, there's some fill-ins.
We know that Priest did some fill-ins. There's some fill-ins going on. So, or Priest isn't the new regular writer, is he?
I'm not sure, actually.
Oh, that might answer that question.
I feel like Bendis going to... We know that Bendis loves to be the guy doing things that Hollywood is paying attention to.
Right. He took over Guardians of the Galaxy as a comic when the movie was coming out and
stuff like
that.
He did Defenders when that came in. He did Age of Ultron right when the movie's and title was going to be...
Yeah.
Like, he's a guy who is on in the pulse of what's going to be...
But I also feel like that this is a smart... It would be a smart decision for DC to
get
that big of
they
a name
want,
on Justice League.
They need Justice League right when the movie is hitting, or they would be very desirable to have a badass Justice League comic that's shaking up expectations.
I mean, it's not going to be as it comes out. It'll be like 6 months
It'll
afterwards.
Be a few months after.
But it would still be kind of like... In the wake of that, hopefully, as people are enthused for it.
Yeah.
Honestly, they probably should have done it so that it was right when the movie hit.
That is my guess, is that he's going to be doing Justice League. Also, Bendis does team books, and he, you know, for all that I think he destroyed the Avengers, he did that by making the most successful they've ever been in their times.
Yeah.
He's been writing Jessica Jones over at Marvel. Has he been doing any other solo character books for a little while?
Just Jessica Jones and... Well, Invincible Iron Man.
Yeah.
Oh, and Iron Man,
that's
true.
That's true.
I don't know, Dave, you had a notion that possibly Superman...
Yeah, this is my slightly crazy notion. You did point out rightly that Tomasi is writing Superman right now and is pretty well-liked.
Yeah.
But I think because Superman would be an interesting challenge for Bendis, because it might make more sense to at least to start with a singular character or a smart character. You know, it's usually just him, probably Lois, and his son, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Bendis's dad... And I feel like he might be able to bring something interesting to the family dynamics and relationships there.
So
I would be kind of interested to see that.
I honestly wouldn't be surprised to see him on something like Green Arrow.
Yeah.
I remember when Kevin Smith took that over and made it like sort of an A-list book. I could see that. Yeah. I could see... Green Lantern's a weird fit for him, so I can't quite see it.
Have we mentioned the obvious one? Like, did we say
what, Batman?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Tom King is pretty much locked down Batman.
Right, but whenever... But for Tom King... Anytime anybody ever said, Bendis, you should go to DC, it was always, you should go to DC and write Batman.
And that's why I don't think he will.
I think so.
That it's predictable. I think that everybody thought of him as the guy who did like Daredevil and Street Level Heroes, and I bet he doesn't want to be the guy
I think
Daredevil.
Tom King...
Except that it's been a while since he's done that. So I could I could almost see it.
He's doing Defenders and Jessica Jones right now.
Yeah, I don't know. How much do those feel kind of the way Daredevil did, though? How gritty are they?
I don't know. Those are both... Jessica Jones definitely is.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know. It wouldn't shock me, but I'd be a little disappointed, honestly, because I feel like that's him playing his company.
And I don't think DC is going to kick Tom King out of Batman.
Right, but there's also...
He cemented himself.
I guess Detective Comics is a pretty specific entity right now, but there's Detective...
There's also a bunch of new Batman books.
They will throw you a new Batman book at the drop of a hat at DC.
Yeah.
Also, Scott Snyder got one. But actually, that's precisely why I think they probably won't, because I think they're a little Batman-heavy right now, and they probably do want to do something different.
You know where I'd kind of like to see him go? Even though I don't know it'd be what I want, Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
I bet he could do something different with Suicide Squad that nobody else has done before.
So, here's just a random question. They say he's moving to DC.
How long
do you think will be before we see, like, his announcement for his book?
Oh, I bet it's going to be the next few weeks. I'm sure it's been in the
works. This will take place after...
After
Doomsday Clock.
Well, it won't be finished. It'll be started.
It'll be started, but it might hint to a new DC
Maybe he's
going to
do a follow-up Watchmen book.
Well, no. I'm talking about it'll be a good you know, new kind of era for DC after Manhattan has been, whatever happens with
that. Yeah, one thing I've never been sure on with Doomsday Clock is whether it aims to leave a notable mark on the DC universe.
Yeah,
it's obviously a big event.
I don't think they'll reboot, but I definitely think there will be a new initiative.
It's an obvious time if they wanted to have something kind of big afterwards.
Again.
Maybe he's going to write Legion of Superheroes. He does have a voice for young characters.
Interesting. You know, Dave, you and I were talking about this the other day, because we always talk about what they should do to bring Legion back. It's like a regular conversation.
Yep.
And I did say, I kind of feel like maybe they need to do a Legion book that is not for me.
Right.
And Bendis writing a Legion book would definitely not be for me, but would possibly be what people need to read.
Well, and also, you know, Bendis, he writes like six books. He's fine writing six books.
Oh, sure. I'm sure there's more than one book. Yeah.
My Dark Horse candidate, Aquaman.
Interesting.
Or a New Gods book, maybe.
Yeah.
Anything else weird that he might completely surprise us with?
I mean, it could be anything.
Could Bendis do a Batman and the new Batman and the Outsiders book.
Oh, that'd actually be kind of cool. Here's the other thing. Let's remember, Bendis is also notable for creating characters. He created Jessica Jones. He created Miles Morales.
Yep.
He created Riri Williams.
Here's my new character, Giles Giralis.
He's a guy who adds characters and added diversity to the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
DC desperately needs that.
Yeah.
It is kind of ironic that a Jewish white guy in his, like, 40s is the guy adding younger people of color and women to the universe.
Right.
But somebody's doing it, and I'm glad.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that Bendis should get credit for, and honestly, Marvel should get credit for.
Yeah.
Even though people who like were so fast to turn on Marvel when the Secret Empire happened, and they've been trying diversity, and Bendis has probably been one of the people who I think spearheaded that.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think that if nothing else, him bringing some new blood to the DC Universe will be useful, because I'm sure that he will do that. He does not seem like a guy who sticks with only the known characters.
The interesting thing is we're all effectively, for what our own reasons, on board this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's great. He's leaving Marvel. I'm super happy. I've been wanting this for years.
Was Valiant like, when's going to be our time?
17 more years,
see
Valiant.
See you in
17
years.
17 years. All right. The other big news, and this one is rumor still, sort of, but it's big and interesting. Disney has been in talks with 21st Century Fox about acquiring some of their material. Now,
is it just material, not the like entire company?
Not everything.
Not the entire
because
company.
What Fox wants to do is spin off Fox News and Fox Sports and basically run them. People in charge of Fox are like, oh, well, our entertainment, we're not the biggest dog in the neighborhood. Therefore, we don't want to be in this. We don't want to be in this at all.
Huh.
Like, if we're not number one, we don't want to be number two.
Right.
Which is so stupid. But anyway, that might mean that they're going to focus on their evil news network and their sports they don't care about.
Right.
And here's the thing. They can't sell the network. Fox Network, the actual Fox Network and FX and all that, they can't sell that because of antitrust laws. Disney already owns ABC.
Yep.
They cannot sell Fox. So they'll have to stay in that business. But as far as like having a movie division and that kind of stuff, they could just be out of it and sell it to Disney. There's a couple things here. The worrisome thing is that not conglomeration. What do you call it?
Monopoly?
Corporation?
Consolidation.
Yeah.
Corporate consolidation is a bad, bad thing.
Okay.
Like, there's like seven corporations that own basically everything,
right.
And that's really nerve-wracking.
Antitrust laws and things like that are good and needed thing.
And weak as hell, as it turns out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, on a level of this is bad, this is really bad. But on the fan level, this points to X-Men and Fantastic Four going back to Marvel full.
Yep, right.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of speculation about that. Honestly, if it meant keeping a mega corporation that'll turn us into horrible slaves in the future from taking over, I don't give a crap if they ever get X-Men back.
Yeah.
That's the last thing that's really on my mind right now.
Yeah.
If it happens, and it can happen in a without us becoming cyber slaves in the future,
yes,
then it could be cool.
Yeah.
I've been turning over my head ideas about how ways you could make the X-Men integrate with the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Do they have FF too?
Yeah, I mean FF is the big thing too.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely have felt that there's ways that they could get FF in even at this somewhat late date.
Yeah. Agreed. I think as for fans, it's exciting times. It's just the overarching narrative of that has been about X-Men and Fantastic Four and not about this giant mega corporation. And I like Disney. I like that they own Pixar and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and all that stuff. That's paid off huge benefits for me. But the corporate consolidation makes me really nervous.
Right. You could be seemingly great guys, but eventually there's a very serious danger that greed will end up overriding everything.
Yeah.
And the nice guys who are running something may be replaced by people you don't really like next time.
Yeah. But I saw someone point out that, like, 2017 has been a weird world. There's some weird stuff going on in 2017. Yeah. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. All right, I think that's it for news this week.
Yep.
I'll be back in just a second to talk about comic books for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, November 8th. And this is first week. Although, weirdly, it was a five-week month last month, so it feels like things got split. And I think we're all pretty much talking about stuff that's not new. It's all stuff
like
that
something
we've all
somewhere
liked.
In a series. Yeah, yeah. That's kind of true. It's one of those weeks.
But there's some good stuff. Nick, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I want to talk about Deadpool because I haven't talked about Deadpool in a while.
Okay, here we go.
Even though I know you guys hate it,
y'all ready for this?
Exactly. No, this is the Despicable Deadpool number 289. It's the third issue of this new relaunch and has featured the wacky antics of Deadpool trying to kill Cable.
Okay.
Because he has returned to his villainous ways, working for Strife.
Was he a villain at some point?
Deadpool, he initially started out as a villain.
Okay, just straight up villain?
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, he was wacky. He basically showed up in X-Force, his jaw wired shut, and so he couldn't make a lot of jokes, but he was sort of mercenary.
Okay.
This is sort of, he's still making jokes, lots of wisecracks, but it's really good. The banter that Jerry Duggan has between the two characters with all their history as they try to sever each other's arms, kill each other, is actually a lot of fun. Cable using time travel against them.
Do they kill any horses or cats?
No horses, no cats. They do kill T-Rexes, Velociraptors, vampires.
See, that's all okay.
Yeah. There's some great jokes. And also, weirdly, the inclusion of Strife, as much as I hate Chandelier Head, it was actually well used. If you have to have Strife, if you have Cable, it's just the side of the coin.
I can't even bring myself to hate Strife. I'm completely indifferent to him.
Really?
Yeah, his existence doesn't matter to me.
I barely remember anything. I don't know much about Strife other than I remember like him being drawn in the 90s because nobody looks more 90s than Strife.
Yeah, that's true.
Other than Adam X Extreme.
That's true.
That's probably the most 90s thing there is.
And art here is by Scott Koblosh, who I have a fondness for.
Looks like he handles the anarchic stuff pretty well.
Yeah.
Slightly stylized, slightly cartoonish.
I would say there's even a page that is very reminiscent of a Bendis book with lots of giant panels filled with reaction shots.
Yep.
No. Honestly, I was in the mood for just something light and fun, and this completely fit the bill. It made me laugh out loud multiple times. And I got to see Deadpool fighting Velociraptors, and that kind of just fills my heart with glee.
Does he kill Cable in the end?
I'm not going to tell you that. Okay. That would be
I just wondered if this was the death
silly.
Of Cable issue.
Death of Cable issue.
But yeah, no. Dave, what is your pick?
Now, I realized, Randy, I told you what my two possible picks were. Of these, I actually don't know which is my number one pick, but I think I'm going to go with the one that is in my hand, which is Royal City number 7 from Image Comics. This is the second part issue of the second arc for Jeff Lemire's Royal City. I had gotten a little bit behind, so when the second arc started, I kind of missed it, and I just caught up and read 6 and 7 back to back. Really, really liked them. This, for those who haven't been reading it, Royal City is kind of a sprawling family drama in the fictional Royal City, with the kind of link that that multiple family members have been seeing what would be a brother, son, sibling who died young, and it's like they've been seeing the ghost of him.
Yep.
And it's always used to kind of bring out some sort of emotional purpose. It brings out something from their past about who they are, about how they remember him. It's funny because right now I'm listening to Stephen King's It, the audiobook version. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of the kind of world building that goes on in the town of Derry that reminds me a bit of Royal City. It feels like it's a living, breathing place in the same way. Royal City is not a horror story like that, but the characters are drawn with that same sort of depth. And there's it reminds me in a strong way of King's character writing. This one in particular, the second arc, is a flashback to, I want to say, like 1993, I believe. So it's a lot of the characters that we knew as their younger selves, what, 25 years ago, mm-hmm. I think? And it's a little bit hard to describe Royal City without just talking about great character drama and things like that. There is still this slightly surreal aspect at times, though, which is a little bit of, I guess, a LaMire standard. One of the kids has been having kind of like recurring migraine-type headaches. He keeps on talking about how he feels like he could almost like fall into this headache and this the pain and this almost hallucinatory sense that he gets when he has it. And when he's getting like MRI tests and stuff in this, as I joked to Randy earlier, it's pretty rare that I might say that's a beautifully drawn MRI machine, but LaMire's artwork is just stunningly beautiful in this. It's
I believe it's pronounced Mrai.
He has these beautiful watercolors that are, at the same time, he kind of draws characters that are not like traditionally beautiful. You can read who are supposed to be handsome and who is not in this, but they all have bear his mark, not unlike Tim Sale or something like that. And I just love looking at his art. It feels, again, it feels like real places. This kid, when he's kind of fallen into these headaches before, you see him in this almost like sort of dreamscape. And you see the electrical towers, you know, those big electric towers, mm-hmm. kind of humming around him, and the way that the sound effects are drawn, it's almost as if like there's something going on with them that's leaking into his head. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that is headed. I don't know what's going on. Beyond that, there's all sorts of other interesting character things going on that I doubt I could really explain why it's so interesting, other than to say it's a the character interactions and the insights you glean from seeing characters you know one way and then seeing them 25 years earlier are very keenly observed. He also does some interesting things where you'll see literally the journal that the kid is writing, and it's interesting because he himself is writing about his parents and kind of trying to figure out what they were like and having that weird moment where a kid realizes that, oh yeah, his parents were lives just like he did and are not just like the providers, and that, you know, they had people and they got together and fell in love and all that stuff too. It's Royal City is a book that if someone were to pitch it to me, I don't know that I would say, oh, that sounds amazing, I need to go read that.
Yeah, probably you'd be like, you could just keep not reading it for months and months until finally the trade paperback came out, and then you picked it up and you're like, oh, this is amazing, I should have been reading this for months.
I feel like that's more something people would do with other LaMire books. I don't have any familiarity with it. I don't know anything about a book called Black Hammer, about which you spoke of, I think, once or twice.
I did.
But you should probably buy the Black Hammer trade, is what you're saying?
And buy the Royal City trade.
Yeah, I was going to say, is just go ahead and cut to the chase and pick up Royal City, and probably most anything that Jeff Lemire does outside of Marvel and DC. He sometimes hits with those books, but he almost always hits when he's doing his own thing.
Yeah, so. I agree.
All right, so that's me, Royal City Center.
All right, so my pick is Daredevil number 595. This follows, of course, issue 594. I'm sorry, it doesn't, because it's legacy numbering, which I still hate, but this is part one of a new story called Mayor Fisk. Charles Soule is still writing. There's a new artist called Stefano Landini, who is a new artist to me. It reminds me sort of Kerry Nord's early work.
Yeah, okay.
Really nice, really good cityscapes, really good character stuff. And the basic plot here is that, Wilson Fisk has gotten himself elected mayor of New York.
Did we see this building up over issues, or did it just suddenly, you are there?
It opens with the big election day in Times Square with Foggy and Matt basically talking over, and Matt's sort of disbelief that he's like, there's no way he got elected. You know, he cheated somehow. How could people have voted for him?
I don't see how this has any relevance to the present.
It is in no way a reference to modern day events in any way. But basically, Matt Murdock works for the DA's office, and so now he works for the Kingpin.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So there's a basically he's like he's trying to work around his boss and be like, well, let's take him down. We know this is wrong. And the boss is like, no, sorry, you're on the anti-vigilante task force now.
Oh, interesting.
And Kingpin knows, so the Kingpin basically has maneuvered him into this position of... Sewell's previous story had been about how Daredevil had gone to the Supreme Court and basically won this right of vigilantes to teleport to remain masks while, and I'm blanking on the word, what do you do in court when you're being deposed or when you're not a witness? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
I cannot find the word. Anyway.
Yes.
To testify.
Yes.
Testify in a mask. That was this big thing, and now the Kingpin has basically undone it by basically creating this anti-vigilante task force. He ran on sort of a anti-vigilante thing.
You're saying an elected official is just going out of his way to undo a bunch of good things?
It sounds crazy, I know.
Huh, okay.
There's also this great bit where Matt talks to his paralegal, and she tells this story about how she had a car, and Spider-Man threw it at the Rhino, and she couldn't afford the insurance, so now she's on buses and all that stuff, and basically she's like, this vigilante's basically screwed up my life. And so he starts asking, like, did you vote for him? And it's interesting.
Now, this is somewhat dark meta, slightly meta territory in the sense that, like, well, realistically, if there were superheroes junking up the city like that, there'd probably be, insurance would probably work a little bit differently. Yeah.
Well, then they talk about how the deductibles are high. It all seems completely plausible.
Okay. The other thing is, I'm a little bit wary of, like, Spider-Man is secretly doing things that screw up people's lives.
I also don't like that, but I thought that was done well here.
Right, and I know Sewell in general, like, that. I feel like that's not a thing he does all the time, so I don't feel like... That doesn't sound like a pattern. It was just just makes me a little bit nervous. Right.
But it puts Daredevil and Kingpin's feud into a different context. And
that's an interesting new direction.
It reminds me of sort of what Bendis would do in ways. It's sort of a, I'd never thought about this version of the character. It takes him off in a different direction, and I really liked it. I think it's a good new...
That actually sounds like one of the somewhat more interesting allegories, I guess I'd say, of modern politics.
Yeah.
We've seen the kind of clumsier ones sometimes with literal walls and things like that.
Yeah.
This one, although it's not subtle, actually sounds like a more dramatically appropriate for the character, I think.
And then my backup pick is Ms. Marvel number 24, which is the last issue before the legacy sort of... The new legacy story, which finds Ms. Marvel and her partner in superheroing, Red Dagger, who actually comes from Pakistan. She met him in Pakistan when she was visiting. Now he has come to America to visit, and the two of them wind up... basically, there's a runaway train in Jersey, and they're trying to stop it without destroying the train. And so it's a sort of a problem-solving thing. And in the meantime...
I always like that stuff.
It's she and Red Dagger sort of talking about superheroing and that kind of stuff because... They're riding on top of this train, and they can't just instantaneously fix it. It's a how do we fix this this problem? And it's good applied superheroing. It's great character stuff. It's nice art. It's everything I've come to love about this book, which I continue to love.
I think I'll probably try and read that one. I'm long behind on that book at the moment, but that kind of sounds like the kind of story I like, where two interesting characters kind of talk through some of their superheroing stuff. And I definitely like these sort of superhero problem-solving things.
Yeah, they do superhero stuff at the same time instead of talking in a diner.
Yep.
Like Bendis would have them do. Anyway, this is one of my favorite books, continues to be one of my favorite books, and it's a great issue. Dave, your backup?
My backup...
Which you stole from me again?
Pick which I stole from you, and I'll do it again,
too. You've done it three times now.
Just so you know. Is the third issue of Runaways. Are you counting?
Yep.
That's good. Third issue of Runaways from Marvel. I think we all like this week,
yeah.
Right? Like, every one of us considered it for a pick, and I won because I'm the strongest.
Yes, that's how I went down. Yep.
I kind of just let you win.
Uh-huh. Okay, whatever you tell yourselves.
He arm wrestled both of us at the same time, like Hercules.
That was one of my labors, was a double arm wrestle,
so I could
review Runaways.
Yep. We're the specific.
So Runaways, this is, as I said, I think of like the first issue... It's not what I usually think I want from a relaunch series, which is to say it's a slow burn kind of building the team, and yet the characters are so on target and they're so interesting in their interactions that it turns out it's exactly what I want.
Yep.
In this one, they have something very specific happens. They go, they're kind of, several members have now kind of gotten together and are on the same page, and they're like, well, let's round up the rest of the group. And there's, so they go to talk to former member, is it Carolina?
Carolina.
Was she a mutant?
No, she's an alien.
She's an alien, that's right.
She's an alien princess.
That's right.
Yes, taken.
And there's a very kind of like, they actually recap her pretty well on her page, but she's a college student now who's actually kind of managed to find herself in a way.
Yeah.
She's not completely, not completely at peace, but she's working, giving it a pretty good shot. She has classes she likes. She's got a girlfriend she likes. She's in therapy, and it seems to be doing a generally pretty good job of keeping her on an even keel.
Yep.
And some of that therapy is over things that happened when she was with the Runaways previously. Suddenly they show up at her door, and they're like, hey, ready to join us?
Yeah.
And is it, why can't I say her name? Gert?
Yeah.
Gert, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
She in particular is kind of like, come on, let's go. And she, of course, for her, like, almost no time has passed. Last thing she knew was, like, for her, a day or two earlier, they were on the run and they were a team.
Yeah.
And they're I forget where Molly is right now.
Well, she's with her grandmother, as far as they know.
Her grandmother. And, yeah. But no, nobody's, like, in any danger, per se, right. That they know of.
Right.
And so Carolina's like, you know, I'm happy here. Why would I return to that life? And a very interesting conversation ensues about that, about like, kind of like, well, what are they doing together? What's the point of doing it? There's reasonable arguments on both sides.
Yep.
There's also some good little bits of humor in here, even though I would say most of it is a kind of very heartfelt issue.
But there's some great stuff with Old Lace.
Old Lace, the raptor or Deinonychus, I should say. Yep. Raptor-like creature gets an amazing scene, just a one-panel thing that I loved.
Yep.
Who's doing this art?
It's Chris Anka, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Chris Anka.
Chris Anka, yeah.
The expressions that he gives Old Lace is amazing.
Yeah, so good.
There's so many. This does not sound like. Like, describing it does not do it justice. It sounds right. Like it's all a bunch of people talking.
Right.
And it is.
And it is.
But, I mean, there's no superhero fights. There's none of it that even, like, the big mysteries that drove Runaways early on. This is just a bunch of old friends getting together, but it turns out that's exactly what I wanted.
I mean, there are mysteries. There are sinister things going on.
But it's not like, like I said, I would normally think, this is something, could they be talking about this while they're trapped in Murder World or something like that? Not Murder World specifically, because that's a thing that actually happened. But anyway, you get my point. The writer is Rainbow Rowell?
Yeah.
Is
that understandable? It's a YA author.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about this. A lot of times when people kind of, when authors or TV writers or movie writers come to comics, they kind of think they're reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
And they're like, has anybody ever done a comic about an aging superhero who's worried about losing it? And I'm like, yes, every single writer since 1985 has done that. But, and then they'll delve into characters, I think, and sometimes think they're the first person to ever think that way.
Right.
Okay, Rainbow Rowell is actually doing that, I think, in a way that she's in some ways digging deeper, I think, than Brian Vaughn did.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying that he did anything wrong. It's just that he didn't quite approach characters in this way, in the way a YA novelist who's a really good one might. And I kind of feel like these characters are very real and breathing characters, and I am as caught up in what is going on to them as I would be in any sort of like suspenseful circumstances.
Yeah, agreed.
Which I do think we are moving towards, but it is working perfectly fine as a drama right now.
Yeah.
About people who happen to have powers.
Yeah, the interesting thing is with the Hulu show, I assume it's going to be a little more. Less superhero action, a little more, teen drama.
Yeah.
So maybe that Rainbow Rowell has adjusted the speed, and this will be exactly what the TV people want.
Yeah, that's...
But it's really spectacularly good. It's better than it has any right to be.
Absolutely. Nick?
My backup pick is a one-shot, Dark Knight's Batman Lost.
Is Batman Lost? Is he in the desert? Does he need to kill a horse?
Let Nick talk.
He is not in the desert. He is actually trapped in the dark multiverse in a prison... created by Barbatos.
Let me interrupt for just one moment, Nick, just to comment on the
format. No, let Nick talk.
Just to comment on the format, which looks just like those other Batman one-shots that have been all the... what do they call the dark... What is it?
The Dark Batman.
Yeah.
Dark Batman stuff. This looks like that format. Is it tied into them?
Yeah, not them specifically. It's tied into the larger story going on. Batman is trapped in the dark multiverse at the moment.
Bruce and they Wayne come from Bruce the dark Wayne. Multiverse.
Yes.
And the cover has the same kind of lenticular cover chrome thing that they're doing. As those. So it feels like it's going to fit in with anybody who's getting
those. I mean, you want
even though it's not an evil Batman per se.
Correct. You want this because it's definitely an integral part of the larger story going on as... This is sort of Bruce Wayne in a prison of his own making, not unlike the Alan Moore Superman story where he's...
Whatever happened to
the Man of Tomorrow. And it's sort of going through Batman's timeline. And it is utilizing things like the Morrison Caveman Batman and all those iterations. Wow. going through that timeline.
Who wrote it?
This is actually a trio. This is Scott Snyder, James Tynion, and Kevin Williams. Josh Williams.
Okay.
So probably
Snyder was like, yes, we are going to, in the tradition of like the DC Metal stuff, we're going to include some stuff that's a little
out there. Well, this is actually sewing up a lot of Batman continuity in a lot of ways. Kind of tying it all together, being it from, you know, the 1960s to the, kind of what Morrison did in his run of Batman.
Okay.
Kind of utilizing everything. As Bruce sort of tries to find his way out of this multiverse, this trap. And kind of trying to foil Barbatos' scheme, it doesn't quite, you know, play out like you think it would, but I thought it was a very, very good,
You know, that seems to be the keynote for DC Metal. I'm not following, Dark Knight's Metal, I'm not following it closely, but it does seem that, as we've remarked on any number of times, that the unexpectedness and, mysterious, you know, mysteries of it all are part of what people are enjoying.
Exactly.
It's unpredictable. Very unpredictable.
Yeah, and it's got some beautiful artwork by Doug Mankey, Alec Paquette.
Oh, wow. Those guys are great.
George Jimenez, or Jorge Jimenez. Mm-hmm. Some really, really nice stuff. So, yeah, that was very, very good.
All right, what else is in your stack?
Moon Knight gets its legacy number one with issue 188. Basically the rise of a new villain for Moon Knight.
Yep.
From the writer, or from Max Bemis. What did he do?
He did X-Men, Worst X-Men Ever, and some other stuff. He's done some... I feel like he's written a novel or something somewhere.
Yeah, I think so too. But it's Max Bemis and art by Jason Burroughs. I have to comment on the art. I really, really enjoyed it. I'm not usually a Jason Burroughs fan, but
Jason
it was
Burroughs
particularly
did,
great.
Is he the guy? He's worked with Avatar
Ellis.
Stuff.
Yeah. He worked with Ellis, doing a lot of...
Did he work with Alan Moore?
He might have.
Did he do any of those? I can't remember if he drew the courtyard, that first Neonomicon thing, or if that was that other guy, Jose Juan Rip. Anyway, whatever.
But... No, it's an interesting first issue. The first issue of She-Hulk's Legacy, which pits her against a classic Hulk villain, has a cameo.
What is it?
I'm not going to say. Has some cameos by people like Hellcat.
Sometimes that is actually an obvious thing that's on the cover. In this case, they're being all sly.
Yeah, they're being sly. And honestly, the art in here by Janoi Lindsay, very, very nice. Again, another legacy, Spider-Man versus Deadpool. The cover has it all, is basically Deadpool utilizing a shark trying to eat Spider-Man.
Like you do.
A big thing about this, though, I wasn't expecting. The art is by Chris Bacallo.
Interesting.
He's going to be doing the first story arc.
Chris Bacallo had moved on to a new plane.
There is some fun stuff with Peter Parker and Mockingbird's relationship as he crashes on her in her apartment. The
Who
second
Mockingbird's relationship?
Spider-Man.
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
I could sort of see it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The second part to the Spirits of Vengeance miniseries. Honestly, I'm like loving
it's
this.
It's really good. I'm kind of disappointed with the miniseries.
I want this to be a Netflix miniseries.
Oh, yeah.
I think just the
Should
bare
I read
bones.
This? Am I going to like it?
Yeah, no.
But I like how they're using
the answer there.
I like Damian Hellstrom. I like how they're using him. I like using Blade the way that they are.
Yep.
I like those characters.
Ghost Rider is a badass in this because it's got a little bit of humor and you're not.
This is the Team Magic comic that I wanted.
And the introduction of Satana here is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good.
Then I've just got a couple more of Uncanny Avengers 29, which is the second issue of their legacy. Brings in the Juggernaut after Lastner. Unfortunately, there's no Wonder Man and Beast in this one, but there's a lot of cool stuff with Rogue and Scarlet Witch and Brother Voodoo.
It's. I was saying just earlier today, it's still a little surprising to me that this book is still around.
Me too.
I kind of like that it is, even if I am not really up on it right now, but that the after effects of X-Men versus Avengers is still being felt.
Yeah.
That this is the sort of, that's the Unity team.
Yep.
And that, yeah, they still have ongoing stuff that was built, like, what, 5 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, true.
And then just two more DC books. There's Action Comics 991, which is the end of the Oz Effect. I thought Juergens wrapped it up pretty well. And then Mr. Miracle number 4, which...
It's a nice cover.
Honestly, there's a lot going for this book. The story is dark. It's a little sad, but I think Tom King is telling it beautifully. So another in the win column
for
him.
Fans of Vision should definitely read that.
Yeah. Yes. Very much so.
Dave, what else you got in your stack?
There's a couple new Image books, which I have not gotten around to. I don't know if anybody wants to jump in on these, but there's a new book called Coyotes coming out that I don't know exactly what it's about, but it seems like it's a... There are these weird wolf attacks along the, like, the America's southern border. Women are being killed, and there's, like, some kind of maybe savior-ish girl with a sword, and it seems like kind of, like, R-rated... darkly suspenseful character drama stuff. I don't know. I'm not quite sure where it's headed.
It's got nice art.
And it has nice art from somebody named Caitlin Yarsky. There's another Image comic that I want to check out called Port of Earth, which I thought had a really neat premise and has looks like pretty cool art.
What's the premise?
Almost looks like a European style art. Premise is that aliens come to visit Earth, but rather than the kind of traditional tropes of they are here to conquer or they are here to bring peace and tech. These guys are almost more like businessmen. They want to establish a port on Earth for space travel, and in exchange, they're going to offer us technology to deal with, like, because they use, like, some kind of water or something like that. I think they use to power their ships in a way, such a way that we don't know. Like, I'm sure it's some kind of fission or something like that. And they're offering their technology or bits and pieces of it in exchange for basically setting up a base here, if you think about it like that.
Okay.
Which is agreed upon, but immediately there are like some incidents, I think. There's like, at first it's like a port where it looks like there's hundreds, like maybe a couple hundred ships pass through each year that are alien ships that we just don't know what's going on. But then the aliens, like, some get loose and, like, kill some people in a city, I think. And they put together this agency that's kind of charged with dealing with crimes and overseeing the peacefulness of it.
Hmm.
Anyway, I think the overall notion is probably going to be about, like, essentially aliens as businessmen, Earth trying to kind of regulate this, maybe. I don't know if it's commenting on those kind of topics in a bigger spectrum or not, but it sounded interesting and it looks nice. On the crazy level, Planet of the Apes, they'll team up with any old comic you got.
Sure.
They would team up with Batman if the offer were made. They'd team up with X-Men if the offer were made.
I mean, there's a Green Lantern crossover.
They've done it with Green Lantern.
That's hitting this week in trade.
They've done it with Tarzan. maybe the Power Rangers next. But in this case, it's double the simian. Maybe much more if you think about it scale-wise. Planet of the Apes and Kong. King Kong.
Yep.
This is literally just called Kong on the Planet of the Apes. And what little I have read about it did sound like a neat idea. Basing this exactly on the continuity of the original movie, there was this like sort of nuclear blasted area that they called the Forbidden Zone and that they used several times in some of the sequels. I think it was like the outskirts of the Forbidden Zone are where Charlton Heston found the Statue of Liberty and stuff, where nobody was supposed to be going. But it's a weird, almost like, not to say quite nexus of realities, but a little bit of that going on. And I think it looks like they're going in here and they find this giant corpse of a King Kong in there and proceed from there. So exactly how it'll be tied together, I don't know, but I wouldn't be shocked to know that it was like, I believe it's literally the Skull Island of the movie that continuity is being used, I think. And there may be some sort of passageway there. I don't know if that's Kong himself who's dead or another one or what. But these guys actually kind of always have done their research. It has, just as it had in there, like Dr. Zaius and General Ursus, I think, is the kind of military guy going into the Forbidden Zone and finding this. You've got Cornelius and Zero, the sort of heroic ones that are playing a role. And you sort of see bits and more about what happened after the movie. So it's surprisingly well thought out. Speaking of timelines, stuff like that, The graphic novel collection, or the trade paperback of Star Trek Waypoint, comes out. This was the anthology comic where each issue had, like, two stories that were set in all the different Trek eras. Not every single one was a winner, but a surprising number were, so I'm probably going to end up picking this up. It generally comes recommended. And lastly, I just wanted to mention, because I don't see Paul Chadwick of Concrete fame doing a whole lot of stuff, he did just the art on this, which I thought was interesting. It's an original graphic novel from Dark Horse's Mike Richardson. I have no idea what it's about.
What's it called?
It's called Best Wishes. I'm just going to read what it says on the back. When two strangers cast coins into a Central Park fountain, their dreams and desires become miraculously intertwined. Cal wants fame and respect, and Mary craves true love from her pro quarterback boyfriend, but destiny weaves a tangled fabric. Sometimes your dreams come true, but not for you. They call it a Woody Allen-esque tale of New York, meme madness, fame's price, and secrets of the heart. Well, sounds kind of interesting. Definitely not one of those things where you're like, oh, that old plot again. Anyway, so that's what I got. Randy, anything?
Yeah. So also on my list, I've got X-Men Gold, which is part 5 of the Mojo Worldwide, continuing the X-Men Gold, X-Men Blue crossover, which I'm really enjoying. New Superman 17, which is one of the only DC books I'm still reading, and has the Justice League of China versus the actual Justice League. Slots number 2, which is a gritty crime book by Dan Panosian for Image. And then I want to mention that the Paper Girls hardcover came out. So if, like me, you've been holding out for a hardcover of Vaughn and Cliff Chang's 80s-infused time travel weirdness book, it's here, and you should buy it.
That makes sense.
All right. We'll be back in just a second, and we're going to give you our spoilery thoughts on Stranger Things 2 and Thor Ragnarok. All right, so we're going to talk about two things. We're going to have a spoiler warning before both. Nick and I are going to try and keep it a little spoiler-like, because Dave is not caught up, but there's some stuff I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So we're going to start by talking about Stranger Things Season 2. So if you have not watched or you're midway through, you might want to give this one a pass, because we might reveal some things you don't want to know. But I think general vibe, I liked it.
I loved it.
Yep. So
I saw one or two people say that it was better than the first season.
I actually kind of agree with that.
I think it's hard to say that because it's like you kind of need the foundation of the first season for it to work.
It's definitely like kind of building blocks. You need the first
season. Right,
the
but there's just the question of like, do you think it was like a better constructed story or it came together in a stronger way?
Let me put it in a way that I think fits Stranger Things.
Yes.
It is much more Aliens than Ghostbusters 2.
Yes. That's nicely phrased.
All right. So basically this starts off with they rescued Mike.
His brother.
Oh man, I can't
remember.
Will.
They rescued Will
from
the Upside Down, and it looked like Eleven had sacrificed herself in order to close the gate and all that kind of thing. Of course that was not gonna be the full case because you're not gonna lose two big characters and the major source of Supernatural.
Yeah. We got all that at the end of the first season.
Yeah, but they didn't fully get into like what was gonna happen.
No.
But the end of the first season, that little bit that we saw, turns out to be pretty important.
It is.
And the sort of in what you want sort of a sequel is that basically the twist here is that instead of them going to the Upside Down is coming to us.
Exactly.
And
now that was kind of happening in the first one, right?
No, not to the same extent as this.
Okay, not that like with Winona Ryder's kid coming through the wall and stuff.
No,
this is definitely a bigger incursion.
Yeah.
So. There's a couple notable things. One is that Hopper and Eleven's relationship, which I really, really liked.
Yeah, it was... that was sort of the bedrock for the season in a lot of ways.
But the other one is the introduction of Mad Max.
Yep.
As sort of one of the new main characters. And I love that character and her brother who... Man, what a perfect douchebag. Like, everybody hated Steve at first, but Steve sort of turned out to be this, like, great guy.
Steve actually was one of my favorite characters this season.
And in this season, he's great. But... I thought maybe they're going to do the same turn with that guy. No. He's just the worst douchebag.
Who are these characters you're talking about? Did you say Mad Max?
Yes.
Mad Max?
Is a new character to fit in with the younger crowd, trying basically a new entry into their D&D group.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm assuming Mad Max is a nickname.
Yes. and her brother is another douchebag. They transferred to Hawkins, which is the town.
Right.
Just recently, and...
What breed of douchebag is he?
He's an 80s douchebag.
Like he's an 80s jock.
Did you think that did he remind you of sort of Robert Downey Jr. of that age, a little bit?
He reminded me a lot of Jared Leto.
Oh, I can see that, yeah.
Yeah, kind of but I see where you're going with that.
At any rate, I liked him. I thought he played a good douchebag.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I really liked Max. I thought she was a good character.
She was a good foil for Mike and for Eleven to sort of get a little jealous of.
Yeah, although really we didn't see that much interaction between her and Eleven.
No.
It was just sort of by distance.
Yeah.
And who's the other, there were two other kids, Dustin. And why am I blanking on his name? Lucas.
Lucas, yes.
Lucas, I thought, got a great arc with Max in this season.
Well, and also introduced Lucas's sister.
Ooh, I love that character. She's great. And then, of course, the Dustin and Steve stuff was all fantastic. Winona Ryder gets a great arc with Bob, who is another great character by Sean Astin.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, Bob is the season's Barb.
Yeah.
But they served him better, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did.
And the big surprise is Paul Reiser. Paul Reiser's great here. Because they set him up like he's going to be secretly the bad guy.
Yep.
And that's not where that goes. And I was really surprised by that.
I was sort of expecting, by sort of the connotations of the season and just his appearance, that he was going to be like from Aliens. He was going to be that character.
They were definitely hanging on to that.
I remember
him as the slimy corporate guy from Aliens who appears to be one thing but is actually the working against them. And so we were all set up for that, and I thought they used that well to subvert expectations.
Well, especially with the subplot that Mike's sister and of their trying to deal with Barb's death.
Anytime you bring in Brett Gelman, it's always good. Brett Gelman is this sort of that was probably my favorite. One of my favorite scenes was him like basically confronting Mike's sister and the other guy.
Yeah.
Not Mike's sister. It was Mike's sister and Will's brother.
Yes.
Confronting them with sort of the reality of their situation and his sort of vodka-fueled reality slap was great. I thought that was really fun. The music is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like occasionally it was a little too on the nose, but in general they used it really well.
I think they're trying to hit touchstones.
Their 80s period piece stuff was really good, although nobody called it KFC in the 80s. Nobody called it
that.
It was
always Kentucky Fried Chicken.
So that was a little bit of a puzzle problem.
There were
one or two little anachronistic bits where I was like, okay, that's...
I'm occasionally surprised that somebody... I assume they have to do... Even if the writers themselves are not from the era, somebody has to take a pass at this and as an editor or something like that. And you would think sometimes they would catch that sort of stuff.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, you just kind of default... Your brain defaults to KFC.
The thing I found when I was watching this as I burned through it in one day. I burned through all 9 episodes in one day. Is that this takes place in 1985, Halloween 1985, when I would have been 13.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just dead on. Like, they nailed the 80s period just about perfect.
Yeah.
And the sort of their Ghostbusters costumes. Like, there's plenty of little nods here.
Ghostbusters costumes are fantastic.
The gripe that I've heard from some people is that it's too nostalgic. Like, all it is a riff on Steven Spielberg and...
Stephen King and all that kind of stuff.
And I don't think that's true. I think there's really good character stuff here. There's an original story. They're building up their own mythology around the Upside Down and Hawkins Labs and that kind of stuff. And I thought they even more so broke free, since this season was not about like a one kid in jeopardy kind of thing.
I mean,
Will is still in jeopardy, but it's a different kind of thing.
Yeah, and it has larger ramifications for the entire town.
Yeah, and I thought that the introduction of it's the aliens thing. The introduction of multiple Demogorgons was so good.
Yeah, I didn't expect it.
I didn't either. I did not see that coming.
And I thought their big shadowy villain has a great look.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about the episode that seems to be kind of a sticking point for a lot of people?
Well, I don't know. I guess I haven't read a lot of it.
The kind of Divergence 11 story.
The thing in New York?
Yeah.
I love that story.
So, okay, we're on the same page, because I thought it was one of the season's strongest.
They do an episode, am I right, that this episode kind of broke from what everything else that was going on?
Yeah. Well, they showed 8 in the very beginning, and the whole rest of the season I was waiting for 8 to show back up. And then we got this little New Mutants X-Men story set in 80s New York.
Very Warriors-esque.
I loved it. I loved that whole thing.
Yeah, a lot of people thought it took you out of the story. I felt it was necessary.
That was on purpose, because we had a big cliffhanger, and then you get an episode where... And this speaks to what Netflix does. If this had been a regular show, and they had done a cliffhanger, then the next week you come back, and it's the 11 in New York hour, I'd have been really annoyed.
Yeah.
But I could just watch it, and then go back and watch the cliffhanger.
Yep.
Like... It doesn't matter. You can just burn to the next episode.
And I thought it actually.
You would have actually been annoyed. Well. You don't think that that's just like even with a regular season that's like just suspense. No,
I think I would have been annoyed because it is. It's like a complete departure. It doesn't even check in on the other stories.
No, it just for the entire hour. It's like let's do our own hour.
Yeah, but it's that week's installment. If they spent a week installment of Star Trek Discovery on everybody drinking around the base and nothing about the Klingons and nothing about the war and nothing about the spore drive and all that kind of stuff, I wouldn't be happy about that either.
Really?
I want my stories to move forward.
I think I'd be all right.
Yeah, but I don't like episodic TV at this point. I need serial TV.
Okay.
So, but in this context, I thought it worked great, and I thought it was a really important character development stuff.
And I think it's something we're going to see more of because I mean that's setting up the third season in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I do think. And I'm coming just off having seen it on Sunday, so it's fresh. But right now, I would say, yeah, I think season 2 is better than season 1.
I want David Harbour as Hellboy now.
Yeah, I know.
But man, David Harbour's great. I love his Hopper, and I actually think the emotional scenes with him and Eleven are the series' best.
Yeah, they're really good. I mean, Winona Ryder gets to play her heart out a lot of the time.
Oh yeah,
but they definitely gave David Harbour more to play this time, and that was definitely good. All right, should we talk Thor?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. So, if you've not seen Thor Ragnarok, we are probably going to do a lot of spoilers here. So, click off the episode, go watch Thor Ragnarok, come back, and then listen to us. Yeah, ramble about it.
What if they hadn't seen Stranger Things but had seen Thor Ragnarok, but to get to it, do we have timestamps for when the Thor Ragnarok starts?
No.
They just have to be listening in and be like, oh, don't want to hear that part about Stranger Things.
Exactly.
I don't
want to hear that part.
I'm just saying, it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
So we went to Thor Ragnarok.
Yes, we did.
I really like Thor Ragnarok.
Are we on a spectrum again here, or is it just you two against me?
It's us two against you.
Yeah. See, this is weird, because I was watching it, and I think it was so jokey kind of early on that I unplugged a little bit.
Yeah.
That is usually Dave's line.
Yeah.
And so, while I enjoyed it, I definitely really liked it, I was watching the whole time thinking... it's going to be one of those movies where Dave and I gripe about it while everybody loves it at the end. And instead, I was like, Dave, too joking? He's like, no, I loved it. I'm like, oh, I'm the odd man out here.
Yeah. And I didn't get to stick around and talk with you guys because it was late and sleep had to happen.
I should say, I did really like it, but I felt like it was so wacky and so sort of disjointed that everybody was talking about, Nick, you said you liked it. It's your favorite Marvel movie.
Yeah, it is.
Which sounds insane to me because I don't even like this better than the original Thor.
Oh, really? I mean, I like the Thor movies probably more than most people do. I think they've all been very enjoyable.
And I think I'm sort of in that same place, too. I really like Thor as a character, and I'm pretty happy with Marvel's movie incarnation of him, even though it diverges from the comics all over the place in lots of different ways.
Yeah. They've been a little on the more fun side. They've introduced...
Even the first one, although it had, kind of started serious... Once Thor kind of got thrown in the mix and he started kind of being his kind of over the top self, there was some lightness in there.
Yeah.
And then even in the Avengers movies and stuff,
but it's a different kind
he gets some lighter scenes.
The first two were a different kind of humor than Guardians of the Galaxy was.
Yeah. Right. This one is, I think, a direct inheritor.
Yeah, this one injects that kind of humor. So.
And that's what I was expecting. Honestly, I like Guardians 2 better than this. I feel like I've plugged into the Guardians universe, whereas... Now, partly, maybe this is that I'm not that big of a Thor fan.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have liked the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I don't have an inherent love of... But my disappointment stemmed from all the trailers sort of promising Ragnarok and the Hulk versus Surtur and the Hulk versus Fenris. And we got all that, but it was almost afterthoughts. And it promised us the Executioner's big machine gun moment, which I thought was not earned. And it was all just a little too
I think it was earned.
Light.
I actually feel like it could have been handled more strongly to make it a bigger thing. Because part of the problem was just that there was a huge cast in this.
Yeah.
They had to cover a lot of territory.
They did.
But that said, I liked it over both Guardians movies. I was plugging into almost every single aspect of
Interesting.
It. Interesting. When it started, I will say this. You know that opening scene with Surtur and Thor?
Yeah.
At first I was like, oh man, this might be too jokey for me.
Yeah.
But I had the one single review was just a friend of mine who's in Cambodia right now said, he's like, oh, it was really too jokey, but still really fun. Literally that was his review.
Okay.
And so I kind of okay, that's in my head. It's going to be jokey. I kind of knew that a little bit anyway. Maybe it was just a vibe from some of the longer trailers. But yeah, when in that opening Thor scene, it was a little bit, almost a little bit too light. I was like, I like Surtur. Surtur was like the big monster doom threat.
And he was just a goof here.
And he was kind of goofy here, although he would later go on to be sort of more notably a threat at the end. He does literally destroy Asgard. But it's not like... So I was talking with a customer earlier, and he was very disappointed with it. And he wanted... he clearly wanted it to be Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And what I think he wanted was, like, Surtur to have the weight of, like, the Lord of the Nazgul or a Balrog.
Yeah.
And I think I would have enjoyed that movie, too.
That's not what I wanted. I wanted this. I just wanted a little... I don't know, I want it a little less jokey and a little more focused. I feel like the division between the Planet Hulk and the Ragnarok stuff, like, it was too much. Like, the Planet Hulk was one story and the Asgard was another story, and I didn't feel like they belonged together.
No, I thought it worked really well.
Yeah, weirdly, I think this is one of those, I'm not quite sure why, say, Guardians 2 kind of left me a little bit cold, even though I liked lots of parts of it. I felt it like a very disjointed story that, you know, took a while to kind of reveal where it was headed and kind of felt very meandery. And I'm like, why are we spending so much time with Yondu and those guys?
Yeah.
And when are they going to get to the point with Ego?
When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
I mean,
is that a thing?
It's a Simpsons thing.
Okay.
I mean, Thor is a little meandering, but I think it all has a point.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like, I could actually agree with probably most of the criticisms people said. I just, like, it was just, like, almost every single scene I was laughing or entertained by. Like, I felt like they brought a little dramatic weight early on by having Odin appear, and I, like, really liked Odin's appearances in this.
I also really liked it. Is Hela really his sister in the comics? That's a new thing, right?
Well...
Or in the mythology?
Is it one of those, like, half-sister weird mythological things?
Yes, it
is. Because making her sort of the lost sister and giving her a little bit of, like, Loki's arc to some extent, the spurned...
Right.
And that she helped build Asgard, like, that I thought was maybe the strongest element. That really... I thought Hela was the best part of this movie.
Cate Blanchett's
Hela was the second best part of it. The best part of this movie is Cork. Who is, ironically, one of the wackiest parts of this movie.
Yep. Yeah. It was one of those where, like, when it started... And I heard his voice, I was like... I actually did not recognize, by the way, immediately who it was.
It's Taika Waititi.
Yeah, right.
It's the director. I thought it was Rhys Darby, but it's Taika Waititi.
Oh, is that who it was? Okay, so I thought it might still be. I actually never looked it up.
Yeah, it's not Rhys Darby like I thought. But
it sounds like
it. Yeah.
It sounds like it. But be that as it may, even though I don't have any strong attachment to how that character was written in the comics, exactly.
This was not him.
This was not him.
No.
This was, you know, a brother in arms for like Thor and Hulk, but he was written in a very different way. But I was very entertained by it.
In the same way that I was highly entertained by Jeff Goldblum's Grandmaster.
Jeff Goldblum was just being Jeff Goldblum, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I mean...
We need Nicolas Cage as an alter of the universe at this point. I mean, we need the
Benicio del Toro
himself.
Was playing Benicio del Toro.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. Again, not like the Grandmaster of the comics.
No.
But a really fun take on the character.
Yep.
I also loved, again, not like the comics version, but their Valkyrie was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting thing to have, like...
Well, we got the Valkyrie from Marvel Universe.
We did. We saw her briefly.
Brunhilde. Unfortunately, she met an untimely demise.
I believe in, cut scenes or whatever, she was more overtly made out to be the romantic interest of present-day Valkyrie. Yeah, that was kind of fun to have somebody who was basically as hard drinking as Thor was, but kind of in a much more cynical, broken sort of way than he's ever been shown to be in the movies. She was awesome and also got to be like super badass and stuff. The part at the end where she's like they're flying through is it Asgard where they're being chased by all the alien ships or no that's they're actually on the
they're still on Sakaar.
And she, like, starts leaping onto the ships trailing them to take them out.
Yeah.
I mean,
and Thor's like, oh, well, hold on, I want to do this.
Yeah.
So, that brings me to one of the things I didn't like about the movie. That Taika Waititi and I think Hemsworth have both talked about, is the decision to get rid of Thor's hammer and to even, like, lightning powers.
Huh?
I did not like that.
You know, if that's their new direction, I kind of don't like it.
It is their new direction.
He's never going to have the hammer again?
Sounds like no.
How do we know this?
That's what they said in interviews. Now, maybe the Russo Brothers bring it back, but the thing is, they open with this great... when they the first time they use Immigrant Song,
yep.
he's got this awesome hammers against like all the demons of Surtur. Yeah. And that was a great moment.
Had they ever showed him using the hammer like that where he's blocking stuff with the super fast things? It looked amazing.
But he does in the comics, so it made sense.
I mean, No, I loved how it looked.
Yeah, I thought that was super cool. I thought him taking on, like, spinning the hammer and using it as a weapon the way it was, like, that was great. And then the hammer was gone.
Yeah.
And they seem to indicate that this sort of new look Thor with the lightning and all the kind of the Raiden Thor basically is like their new direction. Now I don't know that that's going to be the case. Like maybe he's going to reforge it for Infinity War, but I didn't love that. I want him to have a hammer.
I feel like if it was the comics, I would probably want that. For the movies where I allow for some directional changes. I would like to see it back. I think when that happened that it would probably still at some point come back. But honestly, if it doesn't, I don't think it would actually be that huge a problem for me.
No,
he becomes a brawler with lightning powers.
As Odin said, he is not the god of hammers.
Yeah, I know, but he's always had a hammer. I don't like it. Yeah. I do. It's like the unworthy Thor having like the club, and it just doesn't feel
it's
right
not
to
club,
me.
It's Max.
Whatever.
No, I loved all those scenes. I don't think it bothered me for one second.
Yeah, it bothered me.
Again, like, I would like them to reforge the hammer, you know, make that a thing in the other ones. It's interesting, if they do Beta Ray Bill, of course, the point of Beta Ray Bill was that in the comics, Odin couldn't quite, even though Beta Ray Bill had bested him in combat, was still reluctant to hand it over, you know, the thing that sort of made his son the greatest warrior.
Yeah.
And that they kind of came up with this alternate plan to actually forge a second hammer. If Thor himself doesn't even have it, I don't even know quite what direction they would choose if they even do get around to Beta Ray
Bill. I think the nod to Beta Ray Bill was all we're going to get.
No, apparently Kevin Feige did say that he was supposed to be in this movie, but they didn't have enough time for him.
Oh.
So they adhered to their rule of if you can't do it right, wait.
Okay, I'm okay with that. That's good to know that they didn't just think, it's too silly, we'll just nod at
him. No, they just put him, he was one of the champions
along with
of Sakaar.
Yeah,
along with Bi-Beast and Ares.
Ares, right. Yeah.
And they were building Hulk's honor, which I thought was cool.
So let's talk about Hulk.
I
really liked the Hulk-Thor buddy comedy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know what's interesting about it is that it did actually like sort of the odd couple.
Yeah.
It ran it did run around between humorous and like some serious stuff in there.
Yeah.
They also just like, bam, they had Hulk talking right out of the gate.
Well, he was... They said this in pre-interviews, but basically he's been Hulk for 2 years, so he has the mental and verbal capacity of a toddler, of a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
Which is why he sort of spoke the way he did, why his emotions were so, like, simplistic.
Right.
Like, he was starting to figure things out as he had time when he wasn't just being the angry smash things.
Sort of like water, Hulk like fire.
their one-upsmanship was pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, Randy, one of the things you said that was that after the movie was that they didn't have any big surprises for you.
Yeah,
I did. But it actually did for me. For instance, I did not know that Odin was going to be in this. So that was one that I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
I did not know that we would see Banner in this. So it was interesting just to see because...
Oh, you hadn't seen in the trailers that showed Banner?
I didn't particularly remember if I did.
I'd seen trailers with Banner in it.
So I was entertained just seeing him as well in there. Which had a lot of funny stuff. Him having to wear Tony Stark's clothes, and there was a lot of funny stuff with the Quinjet, of course. And then I did not know Doctor Strange was going to be in it.
Oh.
Although I might have surmised it just because of his link from the previous movie.
Yeah, and because of the post credits of Doctor Strange.
And I liked Doctor Strange more in this short sequence than I had in the entire previous movie.
And I found it too wacky. His constant moving the portal around and all that kind of stuff, where he was just kind of like brutalizing Loki. I was just like, it was too wacky. It didn't feel like Doctor Strange to me.
Right.
I felt like the Marvel Cinematic version of
Doctor
Strange. Doctor
Strange, the movie, he was much more serious. Like, it was not quite that wacky. And I felt like I felt like the slapstick got turned up a little bit too much for me on that one.
I think because I like the basic idea that he was trying to sort of police the Magic Universe, yep. and was he was like, I'm going to get this out of here. And honestly, he was like very full of himself. He was yeah. back in full ego mode, which I kind of liked.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and was like, hey, I'm going to help you guys out, so you guys go clean up your shit.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Like
I say, when I rewatch this, just as with Spider-Man Homecoming, I am sure it's going to shoot up in my estimation. Mm. But just like Spider-Man Homecoming, I had a certain picture in my head of what it was going to be, mm-hmm. and it wasn't that. Now, that's not a good way to enjoy movies. I know that.
You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The Marvel movies have built up a certain approach that with a few exceptions, like Guardians, or Ant-Man, where they kind of built in the baked in the humor to it in the beginning. The rest of them do have a certain tone. I think I was kind of amused because, well, like I do like the comedic stuff pretty well in there. And I was surprised because I think most of it worked for me. I was pleasantly surprised to see them make it work for Thor. I didn't feel like, oh man, the Lord of the Rings Thor that I wanted got ruined by this. I almost felt as if the other two movies had been stepping closer and closer to this, and they finally decided, like,
yeah.
you know what? Thor's path has one foot in the space stuff, space Marvel universe anyway. I think it's going to work better if it's larger than life, yeah. kind of like that. And they're like, let's just make that the thing.
Yeah, and I think that was the right decision. I think the not having Kat Dennings in this and staying
although,
away...
Although I did miss Kat Dennings.
I didn't. I think it, much as I like her... Her sort of snarkiness and brand of, like, talking down to the Asgard thing probably hurt the movies. I think
what they did is they celebrated the bigness of yeah, Thor in yeah. this. So when he fought Hulk, they fought big, yeah. like, really big.
Yep.
There was cool action sequences in there. You know, when he got, like, you know, taken down, he got taken down hard.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, just on the larger scope of things, this does move the cinematic universe forward in interesting ways.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it changes Thor's world completely.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, Asgard is...
They almost are setting up a variant of what JMS did.
I was going to say that, you know, JMS had Asgard destroyed.
I mean, Odin basically said Asgard could be anywhere.
Yeah. And I thought that was a good... The one thing that I thought is too bad is that they did such a good job of visualizing Asgard
yeah.
that I hate to lose it, but I like the idea and the sort of, like, big world ship becoming their thing, the new relationship between Thor and Loki as a result of all this.
I mean, has Loki changed?
To some extent. I mean, he's not quite... I did like that they followed up on the Loki stuff so quickly that, like, Thor very quickly susses out what's going
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
But you know...
There was also a very... The Thor theater was a very was entertaining
Did you know who all the people were?
No.
Did you tell me about this?
I mean, I knew who they all were, yeah.
So somebody was telling me about that, and I thought...
I didn't recognize anybody.
So apparently, the guy playing Thor is... Chris Hemsworth's brother.
It's Liam Hemsworth.
I don't think it's Liam. It's the other one.
Oh, is it
yeah.
Okay.
It's another Hemsworth.
Yeah.
And the guy playing
Loki
is Matt Damon.
What?
And the guy who's doing the narrating
is Sam Neill.
Is Sam Neill.
Oh, wow.
Which yeah. is the first movie that Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum have been in a long time.
That's funny. I didn't notice any of that.
Yeah, that scene cracked me the hell
yeah,
out.
Yeah, that scene was really fun.
And, who voiced Surtur? It was Brown.
Clancy Brown voiced Surtur.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think again, I was in that sort of this might be too wacky for me.
Yeah.
But it's a really good scene, and I think, like I say, now that I know what to expect, just like with Homecoming, when I go back and watch it, I'm going to see what everybody else loved about it.
But I mean, in the grand scheme, Loki has not learned his lesson. He stole the Tesseract again.
Sure. Yeah.
And the post credits or the after credit sequence, that's Thanos' shit.
You forget Thanos is coming to get the Tesseract?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how they continue.
The post-credits of Jeff Goldblum's coming out and saying, hey, we all did our part. I was the... Canada Revolutionist, something to revolt against. So, yay us. Go team.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
By the way, for those who haven't seen it, there's a video making the rounds. I think Vanity Fair might have done it. But it's the Jeff Goldblum rating Jeff Goldblum tattoos on people. And giving them a rating from 1 to 10 Goldblums
yeah.
is a must-watch video. Everybody needs to see it.
Yeah, this was... Oh man, I have my issues with it, but it is really good. And I understand what everybody loved about it. I want hammers, and I want a little more... And Scourge's... The Executioner, Scourge's storyline... Again, he's like a janitor, and he's a goof, and then he goes to this thing where he sort of becomes like Hela's, sort of falls in with her. He was never the badass I wanted to be. Even when he was under Enchantress's thrall, he was always sort of the badass.
Yeah. I do think that they probably could have used some more scenes of him, honestly, being a little bit more of a bad guy.
Yeah.
To kind of feel that his, to feel his, the redemption sort of story in there.
Yeah.
Did he survive?
No.
In the movie?
No.
None of, he didn't.
What
the
killed
Warriors
him?
Three?
What actually got him?
Hela.
Yeah, Hela killed her and him and the Warriors three.
Yeah,
sadly.
That one was a little bit of a... I think they had not built them up, I think, as strongly as they could have in the movie.
Hey, look, there's Captain Marvel. Oh, Zachary Levi's dead.
Yeah. Although, I will say this. What's his name? Hogan? Was
yeah,
he the last one
cool
to go?
Moments,
he got some cool moments. Idris Elba got some cool moments.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about what they did with Heimdall.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, people were all mad about it, but Idris Elba, I'm glad it was Idris Elba doing this role.
Oh, yeah,
because he was great here.
He brought, for a small character, he brought this weight to it that you... Ideally, you want in a movie where, like, if somebody's going to be just your ally that you only get to see briefly, but you get a sense of history and, like, this character of their power and everything, that's something that Elba can do.
The Asgardian resistance was a fun idea.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that.
And I love the use of the Led Zeppelin stuff.
Yeah, it was good.
It reminded me of, like, when they first did the Iron Man movie, and I would, like, already liked the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then they actually ended on Iron Man, the song.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, man, that was a crazy ballsy move.
Yeah.
And they've not, like, repeated it, so it's not, like, something that's gotten old. So running with the Ultimate Viking song for the sequence was really awesome.
See, even talking about this movie, I wound up liking it more. I think it was just sort of not in the right mood for
it. It's at the top of my Marvel Cinematic list.
That's crazy. Yeah. It's still not better than Civil War and Winter Soldier. That's crazy talk.
I think it's just balls-to-the-wall entertainment.
Yeah.
And I, as much as I love Captain America Winter Soldier, it is the spy thriller.
Yeah,
and sometimes I want just kind of that kind of popcorn munching insanity, and that kind of trumps everything.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't think anything's going to beat Civil War for me in terms of like the perfect superhero, but Infinity War has a good shot at it.
Oh, I mean, yeah, Infinity War is going to be insane.
Yeah, but I'm also super looking forward to Black Panther. Saw that trailer; that looks great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so. Final thoughts on Thor? Anything else?
I don't know if I have anything else to add. I don't really rank the Marvel movies, and it'd be hard for me to, like, kind of like, I do think it's tough for me to put it up against Civil War or
Dave, you're not a real nerd if you don't have a Marvel movies list.
Cap, Winter Soldier. You know, most of these, probably at least half of them, I've only seen once.
I know.
You've seen, I think, a cumulative through here watching, you've probably at least seen them twice.
Yeah.
Probably, maybe so, yeah. I think Winter Soldier probably still wins it for me. It wins the day because I do lean towards the more serious stuff over comedic overall. But it clearly this has found my particular brand of comedic.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, while still keeping enough larger-than-life stuff that, you know, I still really... I felt like there were stakes, even if at times I would have liked for them to be a little deeper.
Yeah.
Would have liked for Scourge to have a somewhat more serious story. I will say I thought it was very clever of them to work him into the notion of... that he had acquired his guns traveling around, busy playing with Heimdall's gear, was a clever way to work in something which was otherwise require probably some pretty huge story elements.
Well, I remember that was one of your big questions, like how are they going to get in the M16s?
Right,
and like
it wasn't just
M16s.
Yeah, they were like 1980s or 1970s versions, and not like the modern assault rifles.
Right.
So I definitely props to them for some clever thinking there.
Yeah. All right, that wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
Yo Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.